better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tougher, even if they don't. It is June 27th, 2014, and it's Friday. That's right. Your calls today, the monster call day of the week, to 866-65-THINK, 866-65-THINK. You call that number. You ask your question or make your point in the first two sentences immediately, and then you give me details after that if you want to. If you're calling for an expert council member, you do the same thing. Except you say, hi, Jack, this is a so-and-so, and this is a call for expert council member, whoever, and my question is, ba-doom-ba-doom, and then you give the details. Do that, you're likely to get on the air. Well, I'd say right now you're likely as in one-fifth, about 20% of the calls get on the air now, just due to volume. But if you pay attention to the introduction segment and don't skip through it really fast, you learn the secret. Jack has been screening calls for quite a while now, starting on Friday morning with the most recent ones. So the calls that come in on Thursday and Friday, at least for now, the secret is, are more likely to get on the air. With that, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors before we get to your calls. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is Backwoods Home Magazine. Why should you read Backwoods Home Magazine? Have you ever asked yourself, how did Jack get so smart about all this homesteading crap? Backwoods Home Magazine. It's not the only way, but I actually, really, seriously, learned an awful lot from Backwoods Home. I've been a subscriber since I got out of the Army. And, 1993 is when I got out of the Army and found Backwoods Home. It was 1994. When I got a job as a contract installer for MCI. Yes, MCI, back when people had long distance, MCI, that MCI. Yeah, I was a contract installer for them. I was actually making decent money, and I had discovered Backwoods Home by walking to the mall when I was dead broke, when I first got out and didn't know what to do with myself, and that was the first magazine I subscribed to. It is now 2014, okay? 1994, 2004, 2014, that is 20 years, and I am still a subscriber. If I need to give them a better endorsement, I'm sorry, I can't. So next up today, Fortress Defense Consultants. Hey, let me ask you a question. How many guns do you own? Great. Whatever that number is awesome. How many firearms training classes have you taken? If the answer is zero, get in touch with Frank Sharp. And figure out if, you know, his training works for you, and if he says, you know, these are my times and dates and prices and here's where you have to go or whatever, and if it doesn't work for you, then find some training. Just go to Frank Sharp first. Best trainer I know in the industry, honestly. Honestly, from the feedback I've gotten from people that have been everywhere, relevant, down-to-earth training that the student feels good about when they're done, I haven't found anybody with more praise than Frank. Check him out today at fortressdefense.com. Remember the triangle of gun operator effectiveness. There's the weapon, there's the ammo, and there's the operator. Anybody can buy the first two. The second one, you can purchase the training, but you have to earn the results. Frank will help you do that. Check him out, fortressdefense.com. Next up today, I want to remind you guys about the Members Support Brigade. What is that for the new listener? The Member Support Brigade are people that say, I like what Jack does. I think his episodes are worth 20 cents an episode. So I'll join the brigade and give them 18.3 cents an episode since I think they're worth 20 cents. And if you're military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, or first responder like an EMT, paramedic, or firefighter, you email me before you join. You email me at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. You put service discount in the subject line. And you tell me about your service in one or two sentences. I send you a discount code. It costs you even less. I just don't say what the discount is. It's pretty dadgone good. And the reason you would join is, one, to support the show. And two, because, like, if you're buying stuff from guns to gardens and tactical to practical and everything in between in the preparedness world, I've got so many discounts for you. If you just get discounts on stuff you probably were going to buy anyway, the membership will pay for itself. That's why you would join. And then you'll get a whole bunch of additional content that you can't get anywhere else as well. So that's why you might join the MSB. Please consider doing so. If you have not done so already, those of you who have, in a very, I'm in a good mood today, if you can't tell, and a little bit goofy. But those of you that have, in a very serious note that I don't say often enough, thank you, because you empower everything that we do here. You really do. I could turn away from sponsors. I really could at this point. I could just say, no more sponsors. Just, you can't sponsor the show. It's commercial free. I stick with sponsors because they're small business people who have stuck with me for years. That's true. I've sponsors 5 years plus in a podcast. The last time I raised my rates was 2.5 years ago. I have no intention on raising my rates to my sponsors anytime soon. It's because I have an awesome audience that supports this show that's the case. And because of that, the sponsors I have for you are not companies that advertise everywhere and every place all the time and you just send a check and you get to advertise. There are people that have been hand selected by my listener ad council, by myself, and I look at it as I'm bringing you people you can trust. That's my sponsorship, and I can run that program that way because I don't depend on it at all. I do not depend on my sponsorship revenue at all. I like it. Don't get me wrong, it buys a lot of trees and bird food, but I don't depend on it to run the operation. Anyway, again, seriously, thank you guys. Okay, before we get into your first call, let's talk about the year that was the episode. I have two today in the history segment from Alex Shrugged. One is on King Edward III of England, and the other on John Wycliffe. I'm going to actually do both of them today because they're both interesting to me, and I have different takes on both of them. And they're both tied to things, one in the future that everybody will know and one in the past that we've kind of been leading up to. So I didn't want to leave either one out. First one, that old black magic. King Edward III of England dies of, well, the clap, otherwise known as gonorrhea. It's been a while since King Edward III of England has been running anything. His son Edward the Black Prince has been in charge, but he died last year. King Edward III had agreed to support the Black Prince's son, Richard II, as their heir apparent, but he is only 10. When the king passes, the regency will go to the Black Prince's younger brother, John of Gaunt. While John and his older brother had their differences, he will be a good regent. It will be John's son, Henry IV, who will make a move for the throne around the time his father passes away. My take by Alex Shrugged. How do we know that King Edward died of gonorrhea? Last year was discussed in the good old parliament that his mistress was using black magic on royal jewels, so to speak. He died from an abscess. If he had died from the Black Death or St. Anthony's Fire, they would have said so. In advanced stages of untreated gonorrhea, an abscess can form. Disease can spread to other organs of the body. In modern day, death is unlikely since antibiotics can be used to cure gonorrhea long before it gets to advanced stages. In the Middle Ages, there is no cure. Injecting mercury through the penis was tried as a cure in the 1500s and perhaps earlier. Antibiotics will not be invented until the 20th century. Ugh. That's like things that make you go, actually, my take on this has far more to do with the situation that's been set up. So the Black Prince is like this complete badass that just kicks ass in every battle he goes into, gets sick, and he ends up dead. John of Gaunt is his younger brother who's become like ridiculously rich. This could be a TV show, couldn't it? Ridiculously rich through marriage and has more holdings than the entire rest of the royal family. And even with all that potential to just lay waste to the young prince, he doesn't. He follows his father's wishes. And he acts as a regent, which means basically he rules by proxy. So he acts as the king knowing that one day he will turn the throne over to the young prince who has come of age and can now actually really be the king. And his son, when he gets the chance, rubs out Edward II. And what that tells us is that basically tyrants have been killing others and each other forever in order to control people. Yeah. Actually, I have a really interesting piece from The Onion to read for you on Monday. Satirical, but sadly true, that ties right into that. You'll have to wait for Monday for that. Next one, though, is John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe, with the passing of King Edward of England, the heir apparent Richard II will become king at 10 years of old, which is too young to rule. So the regency will go to the Black Prince's younger brother, John of Gaunt. John will use his position to support an up-and-coming scholar, lay preacher John Wycliffe. Yes, that John Wycliffe. the guy with the controversial Bible translation, but Wycliffe's Bible won't be the only thing controversial about him. He saw little need for a pope. He rejected the idea of excommunication and other things designed to delight the monarchy of England. My take by Alex Shrugged. Through protection, though Protestantism was unheard of at the time, a split in the Catholic Church will come in 1378 next year when Pope Gregory the 11th dies in Rome, and several people claim the papacy. Will be called the Great Schism. Wycliffe has set up the core requirements for a Church of England's first split from the Catholic Church in 1534. That's almost 200 years later. It's 145-150 years. The reason I bring that one, the history lesson from that one, is things that happen today may not fully manifest themselves for 100 years or more. And that's why great care should be taken when we make decisions at a level that affect more than just ourselves. And we don't. And we don't. Anyway, think about that as we go ahead and take your first call of the day. I got some good stuff for you today. Three calls for council members and a bunch of other cool stuff for me. We'll start out with a call for me. Here we go.
Hey, Jack. This is Oxymoron Zero Sufimo over on Zello. I have a question for you about diatomaceous earth. Recently, you said that diatomaceous earth becomes inert when after the rain and no longer works. And I have a little bit of trouble understanding that because diatomaceous earth is also used internally in humans and animals to deworm the intestines. If DE can survive the moist and acidic environment of the intestines, how does it survive a little rain and not harm the worms? Thank you for everything you do. And if you like this sort of thing, head on over to Zello and check out the Survival Podcast Network channel, where we talk about beans, bullets, and bacon all the time.
It's a good question, and the answer, I think, though, will make perfect sense. Because on the surface, the question seems to be like, that can't possibly work that way. So, as I said, the problem with diatomaceous earth is a insecticide, basically, as a pest control method, is it is like setting billions of tiny snares with which to kill anything with an exoskeleton or without a typical, like an invertebrate. So a worm or an insect or an arachnid or anything like that. It gets a little bit of the stuff on them. It basically digs into the body and starts to suck the moisture out of them, and it will kill them. So you'd wonder then if you can take it and cleanse internal parasites or give it to a dog, for instance, to worm them, and it works. And it does. Now, let me be blatantly honest about that, though. There's a lot of things in a natural cure world that work, and they work good, but they're not 100% effective. And we in the world of, you know, rebelling against the mainstream often maybe say a little bit too much for the natural remedy than its actual ability. So there's no doubt that given on a daily basis at a ratio of about a tablespoon of diatomaceous earth to a 50-pound dog, that if it has a worm problem, it will drastically worm that animal. But think of how that happens. You have all this DE going through this narrow tube of intestinal tract, and it's in a pretty consolidated area all the way till the end game, if you got me, right? Same thing with a human being. We can take food-grade diatomaceous earth. And by the way, if you feed this to your livestock or to yourself, you should use food-grade, not the stuff for like the pool filter, all right? So if you take it and you have any kind of internal parasites in your intestinal tract, it will help push them out. It really will. It will also kind of be in this clumpy nature going through there, grabbing stuff on its way out type of thing. Now, if we put it around our pepper plants because we have some sort of little critters crawling up on our pepper plants and hurting them and on the edges of our pepper leaves or something like that or any other plant in our garden, and we get a big rain, rain comes down, and it rains and it rains and it rains. Not a little dribble, a good rain. We have now dispersed that DE across a surface area that is inconceivable in relation to going through a tube of intestines in a chicken or a dog or a human. So it is the dilution amongst the totality of surface area with DE that eventually renders it effectively inert. Now, it's not broken. It's not destroyed. It hasn't gone away. This stuff is billions of years old already. It's fossilized life forms is what it is, right? So if you were to go with some type of technology and reassemble it all and clean it out so it was back to pure DE again and reapply it, it would work. It would work just as it will always work. It's not inert from a standpoint of it no longer functions. It becomes inert from a standpoint of it's no longer existing in a concentration high enough to be effective in a single area. It's also the case that the way this stuff works, again, is through getting into something and kind of drying out the critter. All right? Now, if it's in moist soil, it only has so much ability to pull moisture because it's already saturated. Why does it work in the gut? It works differently in the gut. Basically, it works in the gut is almost as more likely a form of bulk, and through altering the pH of the intestinal tract to a standpoint where between the bulk and some remaining effect of the DE just based on concentration and pH alteration, the little crawly critter thingies in there just kind of give it up and get pushed out the end game, if you got me. So that's my understanding of why DE in the garden will stop killing over time. Will it kill anything? I mean, will there still be any little spots of it where there's enough of it in one place to get on something? Yeah, but so the robin will eat your earthworm too. We don't shoot the robin with the BB gun because he ate an earthworm. We realize that the totality that the robin takes in earthworms, he makes up for in other pests that he eats and his poo back down to the earth. So he is an ally in the garden, even though he eats another ally. So that's how the DE would work. I still seriously recommend you limit the use of things like DE in your gardens, but I can see at certain times when a particular plant or group of plants are just getting hammered and you have to stop it or you're going to lose them, I can see why people would do it. I actually don't use it at all in the garden anymore, and I don't garden conventionally anymore. I permaculture perennials. We do need to probably add it to our chicken coops, though, because it is very good at keeping pests off the birds and cleaning them out internally. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. It's Lauren from Indiana. And got a question about guilds around, say, an apple tree or a peach tree or whatnot. If you have a bunch of grass around an apple tree or something and you wanted to go ahead and build a guild there, would you sheet mulch and then plant into that, or would you break up the ground and then plant into that? I'm leaning towards A and not B, but I'd love to get your opinion. And, of course, I've listened to pretty much all of Paul's podcasts, too, and I know your differing opinions on cardboard and newspaper. So, anyway, I'd love to hear from you, and if you want to kick it over to Paul, that's cool, too. All right. Have a great one. See ya. Bye.
Let's start out with the whole cardboard thing, Paul Wheaton versus Jack Spirico concepts. I used to see Paul Wheaton's objections as something to counter directly and to have a conversation with my good friend Paul about, because maybe he would understand that some of his stances are just, well, too militant on these things and that there are biochemical reasons that he is wrong. But then I realized something, and Paul is a great friend and a brilliant man, but Paul Wheaton is freaking nuts. Yes, he is crazy. Out at Permaculture Voices, I had a discussion with him about some of his chicken Nazism stuff, and he said, well, I just think differently than most people. I'm like, uh-huh, yeah, I know that, and no doubt. But I didn't realize how differently. He said, have you ever been to a cider festival? This was out of left field. I'm like, yeah, you know. He goes, I'm offended when they shake the apple trees to get the apples out of them. I don't think that's the right way to treat an apple tree. Good. That's perfect, because now I can take the brilliance that Paul has and I can just chalk up his bullshit to being crazy. It's awesome. And if he proves it, then we'll know he's not crazy. And if he doesn't prove it, He can just stay crazy on an issue. So I just take some stuff like, oh, cardboard is bad for you and stuff, and go, you know what? You worry about that, Paul. You don't put cardboard in your place. That's fine. I realize that cardboard is basically carbon, and it will break down. So my answer to your question is I'm going to sheet mulch the hell out of it. I'm going to go in, and I'm not going to dig a single hole unless I'm planting something into it. And this would be my, if you want to call it, recipe for a good sheet mulching around a tree or where you're going to plant a tree. And what I would do is in that area, I would go in and I would lay down just a thin, just in the totality area, start out with a thin layer of compost. Very, very thin. Just to, you're going to put more, but the first layer is just to like provide some life to the soil. All right. Then get yourself some straw and put down a layer of straw, a scattering of straw. Not a really thick, deep straw, just a scattering. You can do this without cardboard, too. And I do in larger areas where I just want to improve the soil. But if I want to take control of the area, cardboard's going down. And I look in the areas where I've done it and where I haven't done it, and I'm going to do it a lot more after seeing the difference, okay, of both productivity and control of the area. So now you've got a light smattering of compost, and you've got a light smattering of straw. I am now going to take a watering can or some sort of spraying device if it's a larger area, and I'm going to put about 2 teaspoons, 2 tablespoons, I'm going to go glug, glug out of a jug of molasses. Yes, molasses, horticultural molasses. Or I'm going to, if I have dry molasses, I'll sprinkle some around there, okay? Glug, glug out of the jug or a sprinkling around. I'm going to fill about a 2-gallon watering can, and I'm going to dampen the area. It doesn't have to be saturated. I'm broadcasting sugar to feed the soil beasties. Now, on top of that, I'm going to go in and I'm going to lay down a layer of cardboard. Probably one layer. If it's really a heavy grass, tough perennial grass situation, possibly 2 layers. So I'm going to lay down the cardboard. I'm going to get a garden hose or a sprinkler, depending on the area size again and how long I want to stay on there again. I'm going to wet the cardboard down. It doesn't have to be completely saturated, but it needs to be good and wet to where if you pick it up, it would be a pain in the ass to deal with now. So it's wet. It's sticking to the ground. Now I'm going to get more straw, and I'm going to put down a couple inches of straw this time. It's going to be scattered and fluffy a couple inches, but it's going to be pretty. When you walk on it, it's going to feel like kind of like you're walking on a mattress. It's nice and soft for a big, thick, plush carpet. I'm going to put that down. Then I'm going to go and I'm going to put down a layer of compost or compost-rich soil. So either pure compost would be fine, or if you have a landscape company like I do where you get stuff from and it might be like a growing mix, a garden mix, a brick sand mix, a lava sand mix, whatever. But 60% compost or better, or even 100% compost. Either one's going to work fine. I'm going to lay down about 2 inches of that. All right? Once I've got that laid down on top of my straw, I'm going to glug, glug the jug again, and I'm going to add another sprinkling of molasses. Got it? And then I'm going to put down a couple inches of wood chips on top of that. And when I do my wood chips, I'm going to extend my wood chips past the edge of where the rest of the sheet mulch is. Because now you've come up about 2 to 3 inches total height gained. When you put all that straw there, it was fluffed way up, but when you heaped all the compost on it, it's going to mash the straw down, right? And then you're going to put the wood chips on, and the way the wood chips, especially once you wet it, is going to mash it down more. So you're going to give a good 3-inch rise here, and if it just ends at the end, it kind of goes off like a step, and you're going to get a lot of it washing away at the edges. If you bring your wood chips about a half a foot to 8 inches, maybe even more, past the edge so that it slopes down, and when you're building it, even though I'm saying like 2 inches, 2 inches in the center, taper the whole sheet mulch toward the edges. So you're a little thinner toward the edge than you are in the center. So there's a little bit of a cone shape to it. And then bring the wood past it. In fact, the best practice is bring each layer a little further out than the previous layer. That'll get you a natural step down. So you got your light straw and your compost. That can pretty much go on the same footprint. And then you got your cardboard after you've glug-glugged the jug. So you feed the soil with the molasses. Then you put your cardboard down. Once you have your cardboard down, you go to your straw layer. go a little bit out past the edge of the cardboard, the straw, and then go with your compost layer a little bit past the straw edge with your compost, and then go with your wood chips a little bit out, and you'll get this nice shape to it. And water it really good for a couple days, unless you've got good rainfall or you're in a wet time of the year where it's going to stay nice and wet. And then plant into that. And it'll blow up. And you can do that this year and plant next year if you want to. Or you can plant within a few days. And I'm doing it right now for four chestnut seedlings that are fixing to go in at the top of my food forest. It's exactly the formula I'm following. And I'm going to be adding another layer to this. And I'll put out a video on these things once I get them deployed. They're called Iropans. They're actually made by a company in Israel called Talya, T-A-L-Y-A.com is the website. If you go there trying to find out how to buy these things, it's impossible. But if you look up Iripan, I-R-R-I-P-A-N, you can find these things. We're going to put them around our chestnut seedlings, and the areas that we've sheet mulched are going to be big enough. We're going to throw some annuals in there this year, some squash and some watermelon. And we're going to do like half of them with an Iripan, half of them without, and see what the difference is. On an annual, not just a perennial. Anyway, that's how I would sheet mulch using cardboard. If you're not going to use cardboard, do everything I said and just don't use cardboard. So a thin layer of compost, thin layer of straw, and now you don't have to feed it in between. You can feed it all at once, right? So a thin layer of straw, thin layer of compost, thin layer of straw, big layer of straw, right? So you're going to flip the first part around because there's no cardboard there as a separator anymore. So you go thin layer straw and then thin layer compost, then thick layer straw, then thick layer compost, then wood mulch if you're going to eliminate the cardboard. And then I would feed it before the wood chips come down. So go ahead and feed it with the molasses and then add your wood chips. Anyway, let's go ahead and take another one.
Hi, Jack. This is Matt in Arizona. I recently did a pH test on my garden, and it's about 8. What's an affordable way that I could use to lower that pH? Also, in a recent video, you were talking about replanting mulberry cuttings in order to create new trees. Can you talk more about that? Is it possible to be done with any other fruit or nut trees? Thanks. Bye.
All right, so pH, 8. I'm going to tell you, don't worry about it, but do worry about it. And here's what I mean by that. If you start taking care of your soil, you build enough organic matter over time, your soil will support a large variety of things that you can grow, and you'll be very happy with your results. But that said, 8's pretty high. I have soil pHs here that range from 7, 6 to 8, 2, depending on where and when and how you take a test. Most of your vegetables and all do pretty well right up to about 7.5, and with really healthy soil, you can get higher than that.
All right.
But there's certain plants that are like, I don't want this. I want acid. Like tomatoes and peppers need a more acidic environment, or at least need to be more close to neutral, like a 7.0 or something like that. And the easy answer for gardens are relatively small, they're intensively managed and intensively cultivated. Raised beds, bring fill in, it's not going to be at 8 pH, it's going to be whatever you brought in. And if you're using a good mix of compost and whatever, it's probably going to be somewhere between 6.8 and 7.2. And almost anything you want to grow will grow in it. So that's the quick, easy answer. Working with what you have there. The conventional thing to put is sulfur. Sulfur will lower pH, and you spread it, water it in, mix it in, what have you, and it will work for a time, and then it will start to drift back toward the alkalinity unless you're doing other things, and here's why. If you have alkaline soil, it is almost, without a doubt that it's because you have a limestone-based soil. And limestone is constantly breaking down in the soil and contributing more and more alkalinity to the soil. If you had soil that was too acidic, what you would bring in as an amendment is lime. So you have this continuous dosing of an alkaline amendment by nature to your soil. That's the problem. So the solution then is to bring in enough biological activity to move toward the acidic through basic succession toward forest ecosystem. That's how you get it significantly moved. And that is done through continuous buildup of organic matter. And that's it. That's really the only... And then the biological activity in the soil will start to move that direction. So compost teas and spraying compost teas and manure teas, adding lots of compost, adding lots of mulch. Things that you can include for mulch that will move you faster. Pine needles. Pine needle mulch will move you toward the acidic. There's just no doubt about it. And I would, though, look more to create a mulch for yourself that is a combination of hardwood and softwood and needles, if you can acquire that, either from local locations, as I watch a hummingbird out of my window, how awesome is this? I'm just pausing a second to check this little dude out. A little ruby throat, and I've got some kind of a bush with these big white flowers out my window, and he is just going to town. Anyway, that would be a great mulch. And then lots of compost. I mean, I'm talking... You need to be on top of your beds. If you're not going to go the raised bed route, you're going to use what you have and plant in the ground. 2 to 4 inches of compost on top of your growing area. And then a bark and pine and wood, a pine needle and hard and softwood combination mulch on top. And really take good care of that soil. Another thing that you can do that will really start to help move you in the right direction, get some 4-inch PVC pipe. Cut them about 2.5 feet long, okay? Get a flower pot that fits over one end loosely. Sink it about 1 foot into the ground in your beds. And if you have a small bed, 8 feet or less in length, you can have one. If you get much longer than that, put 2 per bed, okay? Put a big clump, you know, a couple inches deep of composted manure down into the pipe. Start going to Starbucks and getting free coffee grinds. Put a couple handfuls of coffee grinds in each one. And fill them, and you got to drill holes in the pipe where it's under the ground. About, you know, close to 1/4 inch should probably be a good size hole. Do you leave a lot of flow in and out of there? Don't worry about your worms leaving. They're going to hang out there because they're going to be compost worms, not earthworms. And compost worms in there and start throwing all your chicken, your kitchen scraps, like number them 1, 2, 3, 4, however many you have. So each day, put scraps in a different one, and that's why you want to get the coffee grinds. You probably don't have enough kitchen scraps to support as many tubes as you'll have, and start adding that. What that's going to do is it's going to give this continuous dosing of worm juice into your bed, and that's going to feed so much biological activity. And if you're doing that, plus mulch, plus compost tea, plus a good application of compost every year, And the other thing I would say is if you're not cover cropping in the winter and you're not gardening in the winter, start cover cropping in the winter. Put in a cover crop that will winter kill, like a vetch or winter pea or something like that. And if it doesn't winter kill in your climate, just chop it into the soil in the spring when you plant. And because if you don't, what you're going to end up with are native grasses and weeds that are keen on the existing environment, like brome grasses and stuff like that, which means that they already do well in alkaline environments, so they're not going to do anything really from an effective standpoint of changing that environment. They don't care. If you're growing things like peas and vetch and bell bean and rye and stuff like that, and this polycultured cover crop, and that's being converted into your soil every year and then overlaid with a layer of compost and then planted into, you're really going to be building up a lot of biological activity. You're going to have a lot more root mass because you've planted it instead of letting it just get colonized by stuff that half-ass grows. You've cultivated it, so you need a huge root mass in there. When you cut that, lay it down, and put the compost over it, it's an immense feed to the soil life. And it's soil life that moves soil toward the acidic. And you realize that if you start to think about how do we get all our soil in the first place. There was no soil. It was rock and sand and clay. There was no soil at all. Limestone. There was no soil on this planet when it was formed. Soil, all soil, is created by life that has the ability to convert rock into subsoil and build topsoil on top of the subsoil. So every place you go with a nice, loamy, acidic soil started out, frankly, in the alkaline world. It took time to get converted over. Forests move soil to the acidic. So if you're not going to do a forest-based system, you're going to have to mimic forest, and you're going to have to bring your own inputs in that the forest would be dropping. You're going to have to put them there. You're going to have to grow them. You're going to have to place them on the soil. You're going to have to feed the life. Let's take a question for a council member. Oh, wait, you snuck one in on me. You said say more about propagation of mulberries through cuttings. Okay, here's the thing. Mulberry is one of the easiest. All you got to do to propagate mulberry is find a limb on your mulberry tree that has new growth. And you can see where it goes from like a hard to a soft wood. It's like a green new growth. And you want to cut it back at the heel, which means you're cutting some of the old growth with the new growth. Okay? You cut your leaves in half and maybe cut a few off. You only need to leave about 3 or 4 leaves on, and those can all be cut in half. This is going to reduce what's called transpiration. When you cut something off a plant and you see the leaves wilt, that's because the leaves are trying to survive and they're like shedding moisture out of the stem, like just trying, because they're trying to suck more in, basically. Like, you cut me off of my food supply and they're trying to find it. Where's all that good stuff that used to be here? It's gone now because it all came from the roots and soil. So by cutting down the amount of green matter left, it seems counterintuitive, but that will actually give you a higher survival rate. Then there's all kinds of ways to do cuttings, and intermittent mist in a sand, well-drained sand, is probably the best. But mulberry is so resilient with this, as long as you take a good cutting at the right time and keep it moist, it'll probably look like hell for a while, and all of a sudden it'll start to green up, and all of a sudden it'll start to grow. It'll put roots on, you don't need a rooting hormone, you don't need anything. You just stick it in a good, fertile, moist soil, but it's not like a stagnant wet, right? And keep it watered a couple times a day, and keep it in shade, and it'll grow. And you can make as many mulberries as you want. But what I've found, as resilient as mulberry is, if you cut it above the heel, so there's no old wood on it, a lot of times it'll just die and it won't root. But if you cut it below the heel, so you take a little bit of the old wood and mostly new wood off a new growth shoot, put that into a moist environment, keep it shady, and it'll do really, really well for you. Now let's go ahead and we'll take a council member's call, and I won't come back until the council member has answered. So I'll play the question and go straight into the council member's answer.
Hi, Jack. This is Richard from Virginia. I have a question for Brian Black. I'm in the market for an AR, and I just wanted to know what kind of things to look for, the particular models that I should look at specifically. I want to buy something reliable that will last me a long time with proper maintenance. Thank you.
Hey, Jack. This is a response for Richard in Virginia, who asked me a question about building an AR. This is Brian Black with ITS Tactical, and I wanted to just give you a couple of quick answers. So you asked about what kind of models, types, and varieties of ARs would be reliable and dependable. And I'd like to recommend a couple of things. One being, first off, I'm a big fan of doing everything myself. So I would, kind of point you in the direction of our do-it-yourself AR-15 series that we have on ITS Tactical that you can take a look at. Kind of a shameless self-promotion, I know, but we did kind of go through all the steps on there with videos on how to produce and build your own AR. But if you're looking for something off the shelf, one of the manufacturers I would suggest currently in the marketplace is Daniel Defense. They make very good, complete AR-15s and platforms as well. So I would definitely recommend giving Daniel Defense a look. I know that you can get them, I believe, if I'm quoting this correctly, they have a builder program online where you can actually customize your own AR-15 using different parts and actually build it online and have it sent to your FFL. So another thing, as I mentioned, the whole do-it-yourself method, I'd strongly suggest parts from Bravo Company Manufacturing or Bravo Company USA. They make all their parts in-house, and they've They are very reliable parts. They've been in business a long time. I know Paul over there personally, and he stands behind every one of his products they produce, and I can't recommend his stuff highly enough. I've got plenty of parts from him over the years building my own ARs, and that's my go-to one-stop shop for pretty much everything AR-15 that I need. So one thing you probably won't find there, though, are lowers. Those are kind of a little harder to get a hold of right now. So lower receivers, but they are out there. If you do some searching, you can probably find a place that's got some lower receivers. But as of this conversation, I did take a look at Bravo Company's website, and they didn't have any lowers. They have plenty of lower parts kits, which is a very important component of building your own AR. Lower parts kits are very important in terms of quality of parts, as well as kind of the bolt carrier group as well, both of which, I'm sorry, the bolt carrier group, Bravo Company manufactures themselves, but I would suggest a Stag Arms lower parts kit. That's the lower parts kit that I've used over the years, and I've had really good success with that. But the barrels themselves are also an important component, and Bravo Company does manufacture their own barrels too. So hopefully this helped you out, and thanks for the question.
Hi, Jack. My name is Tripp. I am currently 15. I just recently attended the Elijah Springs Permaculture Farm. My question is, if I were to start a permaculture farm, what is the most surplus or rapid yield in sellable animal? The details are, I live in Upper Wisconsin, and there are harsh winters. In the summer, many things grow, but in the winter, it is all store-bought and food for animals. Now, I would like to start off a permaculture farm. This is my best angle. But my Uncle Dave is high-ranking with vegetation, and my new current knowledge of swales. Thanks. Love what you do.
So, first of all, let me just say, I love to see a young person thinking this way, and I am going to give you some thoughts, but I'm going to tell you that probably the ultimate grandmaster guru for your climate lives in your state. And he is probably one of the ultimate grandmaster gurus, period, for permaculture farms making money. And his name is Mark Shepard. And because I like what you're doing, young man, I'm willing to make a small investment in your future. And who knows, maybe in the future more. But right now, what I would like to recommend that you do is read Mark Shepard's book, Restoration Agriculture. And if you will email me and put Mark Shepard for Jack in the subject line so I know that it's you and I'll find it, I will, and you send me your address, I will purchase for you a copy of Mark's book on Amazon, and I will have it mailed straight to your house so you can read that book. I really, really recommend that you read that, because everything you want to know about animals in your climate is sitting right in that book right now. And you'll find that in your exact climate, Mark is raising chickens, pigs, cows, geese, and many other livestock animals that we talk about here all the time. If you ask Mark, well, how do you winter over your animals in such a cold climate? He'll tell you, well, first of all, since the purpose of these animals is to make me money by be converting it from walking animal into deliciousness, very few of them actually hang out for the winter. I guess the biggest exception for most people would be cattle, because you're usually looking at an 18-month turnaround on bringing a calf up to market weight. Pigs, chickens, etc. are single-season yields. The two animals that I would say have the best potential for rapid return of investment for a permaculturist doing livestock are pastured chickens and pastured pork. Again, both are single-season. Both are extreme omnivores. They actually work really well in a leader-follower system, meaning paddocking one behind the other. I think adding other animals to a system improves a system's overall health. I don't think, though, that most other animals can really compete for not just profitability, but scalable, reliable profitability. In other words, even if you can't get the big premium you're looking for on permaculture pork and chicken, there is a steady, reliable, available market for chickens and for pigs that have been pastured, period. That market exists, And if nothing else, you could sell it into the general market and you're going to get something to get rid of that animal and be prepared for the next season if you have to go even lower than you really wanted to, but you just need to get some money back and get your marketing more tuned so that you can do more direct sales, etc. It's pigs and it's chickens. In your climate, Mark's done amazing work with chestnut variety development, and I bet you if there was a 15-year-old that wanted some seed from his farm, you could get some. And finishing hogs on chestnuts is the bomb. If you can do something to make a pig more delicious than he already is, finishing his fat little porker butt on chestnuts is like putting a little bit of whipped cream and a cherry on top of an already wonderful dessert. It's just, duh, right? So that's where I would go with that. And I would look into developing a system that is productive for both you and the livestock. If you look at what's called alley cropping, which is what Mark's doing as well, what you're doing is you have this row of chestnuts and maybe a row of hazelnuts, and you have interplantings of things like red currant and a row of apples with interplantings of other small understory. And then you have a laneway, and that laneway is primarily pasture. And then you have another row of these plantings, these chestnuts, apples, plums, currants, hazelnuts, etc. And they run the animals through the laneways, the alleys in between, on pasture. But when they get to a point where the fruit's falling, the nuts have been harvested, etc., they go in and they pick all the premium stuff, the stuff that looks best, that markets best, and it's easiest to reach. And then there's stuff way, way, way up in the top of the tree that's just going to hang there until it's past its prime. And when it finally does fall, it's going to be half rotten. There's also going to be some stuff that falls that you just, nah, I don't want that for market, I don't want that for, so you got this windfall stuff. So they bring them then through there as part of their finishing. So they're pastured, but they're finished on chestnuts and apples and plums. You see? And that, to me, is your long-term goal. Your short-term goal is get the paddock system in, get these animals up to speed, your chickens and your pigs as your primaries, and looking at things like cattle and things like that as additional animals. Get that market established and ramp up. So you start out with a smaller herd and you build it up over time as you can support them more with the land because the land becomes more abundant. Use them to establish the tree systems. And once the tree systems are established, you can actually have more carrying capacity on the land with your animals. By that time, your direct marketing chain should be built. This, by the way, is almost exactly what we're doing at Elijah Springs. Right now, we're making a massive investment in fencing. I mean, a massive investment in fencing to do cattle and pigs and sheep, actually, you know, for lamb and some other things. And it's a huge investment that we have to make to be able to do this. And it's because our land is very steep and we can't quite do nice, perfect, you know, rolling hill style alleys, right? We have to do things a little bit differently. But in the end, it's the same effect. And what we'll be doing is going back and planting very, very hardy varieties of apple and chestnut, etc., just outside the fencing, right, so that it doesn't get molested by the animals as it comes up. And as it comes up in overstories, it'll be dropping a lot for them, and we can bring them around the other side of the fencing to finish them, and they'll get plenty that'll just drop in for them. And you can use hardier varieties of seed-based apple for things like that, because you're not growing that so much, at least in our example, for production. But you have all different ways that you can combine and stack these things. I think that if you said, is there a textbook to do what I would want to do? I would say, yes, there is. Mark Shepherd wrote it. And again, young man, if you will simply email me with Mark Shepherd for Jack in the subject line with your address, if you get that to me today, I'll have it ordered on Amazon for you today, and you'll probably be reading it on Monday morning. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack, this is Leo from Iowa. I had a question about baby geese. We hatched 7 Chinese geese this year, and we were curious as to when it would be safe to put them out with the adults. We've kept them in a brooder, kind of separate from the rest of the birds. They are about a month old at this point, and they don't have any of their feathers yet. And I was just curious if they have the same considerations as chickens do, if you want to wait till they're feathered in, before you let them out into the elements. We are in Iowa, so zone 5, our nights are getting down to low 70s typically, so it's not super cold or anything, but we did have them out with the adults last night. There was some rain, and we had 2 losses this morning. I'm not sure if that was from exposure or if they got smothered. They looked kind of squished. I didn't notice any broken bones or anything like that. But, I was just curious if there were any rules or typical suggestions that people are given for when is a good time to leave the babies out with the adults. So look forward to your answer. Thanks.
I'm not real concerned about the cold for your geese at this point. I have huge concern with them being introduced to the adults at this point. And I can tell you it may be possible that even if those are geese that you hatched and they are the prodigy of this flock you've put them in with, it is very possible that your adult geese murdered them. Our Toulouse geese have killed chickens. They killed one young chicken that was foolish enough to go into their area, into their confined area that they're in at night. This chicken got out of his little paddock that we had him in when he was coming up. It was still pretty young. Managed to fly over the fence, but probably couldn't figure out how to fly back over the fence. They're kind of stupid that way. And, we just disappeared. Like, we just were missing one. And we finally, like, I was in there cleaning out their area, and then there's this, you know, lump, and it's a dead chicken. When they had their goslings that the female goose finally went broody and hatched her own, they went psycho for like a while. Like, as long as she was not just when they had them, like the time she was on the nest until they started to kind of feather out themselves, they were like not just the barnyard mafia, they were like the barnyard hitman. And we had one of our pullets, we had two, and the other one, first, sorry for your loss anyway, losing animals is, it's hard, man, because, you know, you feel like it's your responsibility, even if they're destined to be, you know, slaughtered, while they're here, you're responsible for taking care of them. I just lost another one of my pullets last night. The one they killed, the geese killed, was one of the big Red Ranger females that we kept, and I kind of liked having them in the flock, and we had her sister, and we don't know what happened to her. She just disappeared yesterday. So that could be a predator issue. We don't really have, especially daytime predation from canines here. It could have been a hawk, but this is a bird that weighs almost 10 pounds. So you're talking at like a big hawk, like, you know, or like a red tail, or I can't think of what those ones are called. They're not Coopers. Coopers are small. The big kind of gray and white ones that we see, or brownish white, you know, ones that we see on the highways around here. And I haven't seen any around here. So one of those would be big enough to take her. And she's disappeared. So I understand when you lose an animal. But they killed this other one. And when I walked out there, it was dead. And the one gander was just, I mean, the other geese had gone on about their lives. And this bird had been dead a while. He was just still hammering it. So when geese are in an area and confined with animals that they have not taken into their gaggle, they could become very aggressive and they can kill them. And it's quite possible that they killed them. Here's why I say this. When our goose hatched out her 4 young goslings, and again, we lost one of those. One of them just vanished, just disappeared. And that, I think, probably was a hawk. It was a smaller animal, and even though the geese will defend their babies to the death, a bird can come in, take it, and go. But the other 3 have done fine. They've been outside in the elements since the day they hatched with their mother. But their mother has cared for them. And she's done so because she's aware that they're hers. Because she was broody, they hatched out underneath her. So my suggestion in the future is if you can get a goose to brood and go broody, put the eggs under her or leave the eggs under her. And one of the things you can do is when she starts laying, leave the thing that'll make them not go broody is when they just don't have any eggs to go broody over. Because they'll lay and they'll leave and they'll come back and lay again. So what you can do is pick 2 or 3 eggs and mark them with a Sharpie with an X when she's not broody and leave them. They're going to die because it's going to be too cold in the year and she's not taking care of them. But that way, when she's laying new eggs, you can keep taking eggs. And you can save those eggs for 7 to 10 days on a shelf, and then you can choose to either start incubating them or eat them. You can refrigerate them and eat them, or you can start incubating them. If you start incubating them and she goes broody, you can take them and put them underneath her. You can mark them for how, you know, for however many you want to hatch, and you can start taking her new ones from her. Now, she's going to come after you when you take them, but you could do it. That way you'll get an even hatch and they'll all come out at the same time. Or you can kind of, usually, so far, what I've seen is they go broody right toward the end of their laying cycle anyway. So you're going to end up with a pretty even hatch anyway that way. If she has those geese herself, like I said, even if she goes broody and you've been incubating them for half the incubation period, take them out of the incubator and put them underneath her. You don't have to do anything. If you're in your situation, there's probably no doubt right now that your geese can survive outside, but they cannot be with those adults. We had our ducks and geese out on grass in a duck and goose tractor type situation together. Buddy and the Jets, we call them, right? Buddy and the Ducks. When they were probably 4 weeks old, they weren't going into the brooder at night. They were spending their days outside at 2 weeks of age. They were coming outside, spending their days outside. 4 or 5 weeks into it, we started leaving them out because they make such of a mess out of the brooder. Geese and ducks both just make a horrible mess out of the brooder. I think they're actually more likely to survive outside because they're not going to get all wet and pasty and gross confined in a brooder when they make just a huge mess out of everything. We have a small 4-foot by 8-foot chicken tractor that we put pallets on the top of. And it's real easy then to move that every day or even twice a day for them while you're brooding them. I would not put them with their adult flock until they are at least half grown and feathered out. And not so much because they're feathered out, but because they'll be half grown when they're really feathered out. When you can look at them and they look like small adults, right? When they have their colors and their markings and all, by that point they're pretty tough and they know how to look after themselves. Even at that point, I would be careful about forcing the integration with the flock. You kind of have to leave them in a free choice environment and let them pick where they're going to sleep and things like that. Where you get geese killing other birds is when they're confined in a small area and that other bird can't leave. Geese generally won't stay on the pursuit of another animal. They'll chase it away, and then they'll honk and wag their tails and fluff their feathers and their wings and feel all badass about themselves. But when that other animal can't retreat, that's when they'll kill them. And it's very possible that they killed those two young birds. It's probably more likely that they were killed than they were all huddled together being nice and were crushed just by being in there. Because it's not likely that an adult goose is going to crush a young goose unless it wants to. So I would keep them separated for quite a while yet. And I don't think it's environmental. I think it's the adults hurting them. And they'll do it. Right now, I've got Buddy, and Buddy has been separated, you know, since birth, and Buddy came up with the ducks, and Buddy likes the ducks. And one gander's kind of taken a liking to Buddy, because again, I think he's Buddy yet, but recently they went in their area and Buddy was near there, so I kicked his butt in there and closed the door. They kind of ignored each other for a while. Buddy ran to one side, the mafia went to the other side. It's a pretty big caged area. And then Buddy started honking, and his minions, his four ducks, that are older than the rest of the duck flock, heard him and ran. It was kind of sad, you know. They're on the outside looking in like he's in prison. And they're quacking and he's honking, but everybody was cool. And I'm like, let's see where this goes. Let's see if they'll start to have some integration. And everything was fine until Buddy decided, well, the door's over there and that's where they are. And I'm afraid of them, but I'm going to go over. And as soon as he went over there, two of the large ganders came after him. So they're just not ready to be integrated yet. So we free range them all day and they interact with each other. And sooner or later, especially if Buddy's a girl, then the problem will solve itself because somebody's going to take Buddy as a mate. If Buddy is a male, my wife's not going to like this, but we have too many males already. So Buddy's a nice, succulent young goose, and he may be Buddy a la roast if he turns out to be a he. It's hard to tell geese. They're not sexually dimorphic, really. Except females are smaller and they have different behaviors. Looking at the way Buddy behaves, I'm pretty sure Buddy's a girl, but we will see. Anyway, those are my thoughts. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Pierre from Down Under in Western Australia. I have a question for expert council member Keith Snow. It's in regards to cooking Jerusalem artichoke. I know he's answered questions like this before, but basically the idea is I love the flavour of it. I'm growing some in my cousin's garden because I'm in a rental property and I don't have the space to actually grow it myself. So I've convinced my cousin to grow it. She's diabetic, and I thought it would be a good source of food for her and obviously for myself when I finally get a garden bed that I can actually grow the stuff in. My question is this. I love this stuff. I've bought a bag of the Jerusalem artichokes the other day. I've cooked them up. How I did it was boiled it and then sauteed it in butter and garlic. Basically, it's the way I'd normally cook potatoes. I come from a French background, so that's my culinary kind of background. My problem is that I love the stuff, but she has a dislike of the flavour of artichoke. So I was wondering if Keith could actually tell me any way that you could cook it. Obviously use the Jerusalem artichoke and somehow overpower the artichoke flavour, which, like I said, personally, I love the flavour. But because my cousin doesn't like it, and her being diabetic, I thought it might be a good thing for her to eat, would be to get rid of the flavour or overpower it with something else that would be used in some kind of recipe. Glad to hear any thoughts or any ideas from maybe even yourself, Jack. Love the show. Keep up the good work. Talk soon. Cheers. Bye.
Hey, it's Chef Keith Snow. Wanted to answer the question of my good buddy Buckweed, commonly known as Pierre, down in Australia, who called in about sunchokes. Now, Pierre, you're right to consider the sunchoke for, I think it was your sister or friend, that is potentially maybe pre-diabetic or even a full-on type 2 diabetic. This is a good vegetable in that it doesn't elicit the same type of blood sugar response that normal potatoes would, and that's because the carbohydrate inside of the sunchoke is a little different. It's a substance called inulin, and if you look on a lot of different products in the market, you know, sometimes you'll see it in soy milk and yogurt drinks, things like that. Other processed foods, they're adding inulin, and they get it from sunchokes in a lot of cases. And it's a fiber that will bulk up your stomach when you're eating something like that. You'll feel more full. That's because of all that extra fiber. Now, it also contributes to the reason that the sunchoke or Jerusalem artichoke, as they call it, and by the way, it's not from Jerusalem, and it's not related to the artichoke. It's actually a cousin to the wonderful and beautiful flower family, and you guys have seen these things along the roads. It's part of the sunflower family, but it does not... It doesn't raise the blood sugar, but with all that inulin, all that fiber in there, they do have a tendency to be a musical fruit, so to speak. Those of you that know what I'm talking about, flatulence, they can make you a touch flatulent. But that's honestly, if you're, you know, you go and pound a huge bowl of them, maybe that will be the case. But these are too important a food, I think, to worry about that. Now, these sunchokes will look just like sunflowers. They grow really tall. They put out some pretty flowers, and most folks do not know what's underneath the ground. So those of you, like I've mentioned before, that have maybe you're gardening and you just don't want people to know what you're gardening, these are pretty innocuous because they look just like sunflowers, but underneath are these wonderful sunchokes, and they're just little tubers, and they don't look like a potato at all. They look, I want to say kind of like a yuca, but not as dark. But they're just little tubers, and you can peel them and use them in a ton of different ways. Now, one way that I really love to eat these Jerusalem artichokes is shaved and raw. Now, just like a potato, when you peel that skin off, they're going to want to oxidize or turn brown on you. So what's cool, if you're going to use them in a salad, you can toss them in the same lemon juice or vinaigrette, whatever you might be going to use them in, and then they'll keep from oxidizing. But they're terrific in salads. It's very similar texture. If those of you are familiar with another sort of root vegetable called jicama, and that's J-I-C-A-M-A, jicama, makes a wonderful raw vegetable, and it's got a similar sort of like a pear and a potato, so, or an apple and potato mixed together, if you can imagine the texture. But the sunchokes are great like that, raw. You can make salads out of them, and they're wonderful like that. Think of them as like a cooling vegetable. You could toss it in just a very light little vinaigrette, maybe a mustard vinaigrette, and you could put it on top of salads, on top of vegetables. But then it also behaves so much like potatoes. They're terrific roasted, mashed. You can just boil them and then add butter to them. But one of the most famous ways they're served, and these things are a lot more popular over in Europe than they are here. In fact, in Germany, they grow a lot of these things, but they use them to make a certain alcohol because they're also very good for turning into booze. But Jerusalem artichoke soup is probably, I would say, the biggest or most popular way to use these. So don't forget about making a wonderful, and it's usually a creamy type soup. So these are great for people, like I said, that are pre-diabetic or folks that have some land and want to grow a great crop that is super, super easy to grow, and they're very prolific. They're a lot easier to manage than potatoes, but you do have to deal with a large amount of vegetable matter or root matter above the ground, which potatoes usually are knee-high or something like that. But these things, they make themselves known, but again, most people think they're sunflowers. I wanted to chat briefly to you guys and gals out there in TSP land. This dude that I'm answering the question for, Pierre Buckweed, he's frequently over at my facebook.com/harvesteating page. He's a really great dude. And it's just a testament to how many awesome people are in the audience. You guys and gals are some of the most genuine people. Now, I've never really told this story, but hopefully Jack doesn't cut me off. But in doing harvest eating since 2005, I've come across so many groups of people, whether it be, I don't want to sound too negative, but the real organic people, we'll leave it at that. And then folks, that think the way we do here at TSP. Now, this has been just the most amazing group of people to deal with. You guys and gals out there listening. So many genuine friendships I've created, with the TSP audience. I just wanted to, I mean, I don't know how I can give you a big group hug, but you guys are awesome out there, and a testament to what Jack has built. I know he knows that it's the audience that makes TSP what it is. And it's amazing how, great a group of people, are in one place supporting a show and interacting with each other. And you guys do a great job of taking care of us sponsors by coming over, and you know, a lot of you listen to my podcast, and a lot of you are supporting Harvest Eating by purchasing spices and all that, and I really appreciate that. A little programming note to that end, Jack did a video not too long ago, and he featured some of my rubs, and it caused a pretty good stir of orders, and we were well stocked up, but one of our spices went back order, and that was darn, the most important one, which is the Montana steak seasoning. So that came back in stock, and the post office person was just overwhelmed with orders. So if you've made an order in June, I would say it's on the way to you, because we shipped out a bunch of orders this week. So thank you guys so much for all that business. And I want to let you know that I have not discontinued the coupon code BEACH, and that's important because as a TSP member, you save 15%, but with this BEACH coupon, you get 25%. Also, we are shipping our Thoughtful Harvest pasta sauces. We just sent about a full case to our buddy Jack Spirico. He ordered the creamy basil pesto. It's actually one of my favorite varieties. Really good. The other thing I wanted you to know is when your spices arrive, those of you that order them all the time, we are now in a new package, and it's a wonderful stand-up pouch, and it's got a really strong zipper on top and then a seal. We were having some issues with some of our other canisters finding their way open just because there's so much shaking going on. But that's all I want to say. Thank you guys and gals so much out there in TSP land. And I hope this answer will give Pierre and those of you interested in sunchokes just a little information about them, because they are a really cool vegetable. So with that, it's been Chef Keith Snow here at the Expert Council. Hope you guys have a great weekend. Take care.
Great stuff from Keith. I'll tell you that, like, the best tasting way I've ever done them is I use my chili garlic oil and I just pan fry them. So my chili garlic oil, real quick, you fill up a small pot halfway or whatever much you want to make with peanut oil is what I use to do this. And then crumble up some Thai red chili peppers. And I'll actually put a link in today's show to Amazon for the peppers that I buy. They come from overseas, and they're on Prime, and they ship, and you get them in 2 days from overseas with a customs label on them. I don't know how Amazon does this, but they're the best peppers. I need to plant some of the seeds of this pepper and see if it'll do well here. It's a dried Thai chili. I just take a big handful and crumble them, and I throw them in the oil. And then you take a big handful of black peppercorn and throw it in the oil. And then chop up an entire garlic head, right? Not just a clove, but all the cloves that make up one. Coarsely chop those. So you can just basically take it apart, roll it, and get the paper off of the cloves. Cut them in half, break them in half, whatever. Throw them in that oil. Turn your heat up really, really gently. Start heating the oil and watch it. The second you see one little bubble, like it's just barely ready to start frying your garlic and your peppers, kill the heat. And most of you that don't have a gas stove, the burner is going to stay hot and it'll still raise the temperature of the oil more and it'll go into a full fry. You don't want this. So take it off, cover it, and let it sit. Then put it through a strainer into a jar and save it like that. And then what I usually do is I throw in a handful of peppercorns and like one or two whole chili peppers in that jar, submerged in the oil, and maybe a couple cloves of garlic, and I leave it like that, and then I cook with it. That used to pan fry artichokes is great. I will say this, though. Pan frying artichokes, the problem is they get a lot softer than potatoes do. It's harder to get them crisp. We're thinking about getting a small deep fryer just to deep fry artichokes in, just because they're so damn good. And as a paleo person, for everything Keith told you about the difference in their carbohydrate makeup, they're one of the few things like that that I really can eat in significant quantities. They are musical quite rapidly. But I will say this about the fartichoke factor. You fire blanks. They're noisy, but they're cool and dry. And we all know what that means. They're not noxious. Let's take another one.
Hello, Jack. I was wondering who you would pick for the World Cup final this year. Scott from Missouri. Thank you.
This will be the most rapidly, quickly answered question ever on TSP for a call-in question. I don't know. I don't really care about soccer, and I can just tell you that it won't be us next question.
Jack, this is Keith in Colorado. Hey, so here's a question about how the gas tax would be implemented and how they might have done this already with other things in the past. The question is, do you think this is how they got the citizens to say the driver's licenses were needed in order for all people to travel, regardless of if it's a commercial vehicle or a private vehicle? What I mean by that, little explanation. Back in the, 1910s, 20s, 30s, 40s, were driver's licenses as common as they are today? Registration maybe, but we've seen many Supreme Court cases and court cases that say no. You know, obviously your right to travel should not be impeded upon by a state which is going to issue a license. But then again, if you look at any states, now driver's licenses are all in effect nationwide. There's nowhere you can go where you don't have to have a driver's license. Colorado Article 42-2-101 used to say that driver's licenses are for commercial vehicles and purposes only. And now all of a sudden the Colorado Revised Statute has even gotten away with limiting 49cc scooters. Now all public or all motorized vehicles on public roadways must have an operator with a valid driver's license. So love what you do. Talk to you soon. Bye.
It's a reoccurring theme in the liberty movement that we're not supposed to have a driver's license, and driving's a right of travel. It's stupid. It's dumb. It doesn't work that way, and it's not going to work that way as long as the government owns the roads, which means the people own the roads, which means the people get to decide what's required to drive on the roads. This is one of these things I'm having a debate with a guy in the comments section on and off with right now. Great guy, but just head up his butt about this one. Let me explain this to you. The whole mileage tax and everything, we're just going to shelve that. I've told you how that's going to happen. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you have a driver's license or not. This is how it works. This is why you have to have a driver's license. This is why it's actually reasonable under the current situation, under the current system, that you would have a driver's license. Let's say I buy myself a piece of property, 100 acres, and I want to cut every tree down on that piece of property. That might be a bad idea, but it's my property and I can cut it down, and there ain't nothing anybody can do about it unless I live in some eco-weenie area where they might try to stop me. But in general, I can cut all the trees down if I want to. And if I want to build a house out of them, I can. If I want to sell them to a timber company and replant it into maybe it's a good thing I want to cut them all down. Maybe I want to put it into a productive permaculture system. So if I want to do that, I can do that. No problem. No one can say jack diddly crap. And I don't need a license and I don't need permission to do it. It's my land. I bought it. I own it. I know what you think I'm going to say. You think I'm going to say that, well, if you bought a road, you can drive on it. I can. And on that piece of property, I can have no license, no insurance. I can drive and crash into an oak tree if I want to. And nobody can say nothing about it because it is my land. But that's not my point I'm going to make for you today. Let's reevaluate how this land gets bought. Let's say that I say, you know what? I want to buy 100 acres of land in Texas to have as like a bug out location and a hunting piece of land, recreational land, stuff like that. And I'd like anybody in this audience that wants to go in on it with me to let me know. I'm going to take 20 people. Let's say 25 people, right? 25 people. And then we're not all going to own 4 acres. We're all going to own all 100 acres. We'll all be deeded equal. And I want everybody that wants to be part of it with me, come in with me. And we'll own this piece of property. Okay. Now we're all owners of the property. Okay. Is it okay for me to cut down all of the trees on that piece of property without talking to the other 25 guys? You know what the answer is? No, it's not okay. And with that many people to decide what happens on the land, we would have to have some kind of an agreement in place, and it would probably involve a vote. Do we clear this acre? Yes or no? Jim wants to, Tom doesn't, Jack doesn't want to, Tim does, whatever. Eventually you go to a vote, and we would have to have, as owners, an agreement. There has to be a 75% vote yes, or 100% vote yes, or whatever. Whatever we want to do, it's our piece of land. But in the end, we're going to be in a situation where we have to collectively make decisions about how to manage the land. Here's how it works. The government steals all of our money and builds roads with it. They're called public roads. And you say, well, I have a right to travel on a public road. You have absolutely the right to travel. You don't have the right to drive a 6,000-pound vehicle at 100 miles an hour with no understanding of how a vehicle works and no proof that you do. And no accountability for discretions that endanger other owners of the road. We all own the road publicly. I'm not saying this is how the system should work. I'm saying this is how the system does work. And I think that this is where I start to take certain people in the liberty movement, and you are what I call a lignoramus, right? A libnoramus. Liberty ignoramus. Together. Like they call people libtards in the liberal world. Well, you're a libnoramus here. Because you don't understand reality and how it works. Now, in my solution, the government wouldn't own the roads. people would build roads and manage them however they saw fit. And Tim would say, this is my road. Drive on my road. You got to have a car. You got to be behind the wheel. And you got to not do something stupid. And Tom would say, this is my road and you want to drive on it. I require you have some kind of certification that proves you're not an idiot and you know how to drive a car. And it would be fine because everybody would set their own standards as to how it would work. And then you go, is that practical? And for as much of an anarcho-libertarian as I am, I don't know that it is. Right? That's why I move more toward the minarchist component of things, saying there is some role for some level of collective decision making for people and ensuring that like shit can get from one part of the country to another. Seems if there is any legitimate role for government, that would be it. I mean that would be a legitimate if you took people and put them in a room and said, should government be doing X? You'd end up with a lot of people that say, well, they should be doing these things, but not those things. And a lot of people that should say, well, they should be doing those things, but not these things. And they'd be very, very different, and it would probably be very, very well divided amongst the typical paradigm of liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican. But you'd find a lot of people even bifurcating off of their own, going, well, they really don't need to be doing that much with that. But then you would have this one place, this nexus, where even the two people in the false dichotomy would come together and say, well, yeah, that's that. If there's anything they should be doing, they should be doing that. Roads and bridges and infrastructure would probably be the place that people came together. So you're probably always, no matter how close to a stateless society we get, certainly in the lifetimes of every living human being right now, going to have at least the infrastructure for transportation publicly managed. And it probably is the best solution we have for right now. It probably is. And if that's the case, then I have as much right to that road as you do. And your rights, okay, do not get to infringe upon my rights. That's how rights work. Rights are not something such that you have them to the exclusion of what you do with them. Rights are something that exist to you as an individual. They're not granted to you, just have them. But the minute that you encroach upon the rights of another, you inherently give up your rights. And this is what I mean by that. You have a right to life. You have a right to life. There's nobody out there with a brain that's not a totalitarian that would say human beings don't have a right to just live. You have a right to live. Okay, the minute you try to harm me, I have the right and probably the duty to my family to put a bullet in your freaking head and kill your ass because your right to be alive is now terminated by your intent to do me harm. Got it? And I'm telling you right now, I'll do it. And most sane people will too. If I think you legitimately could harm me to the point where I'm either going to die or I'm no longer going to be able to take care of my wife, you are dead, fool. You shouldn't have done it. Right? Okay, and most people with a brain would go, well, he was acting in self-defense. Well, that other man had a right to live. He had a right to live right up until the point that he attacked another human being, and then his right was terminated by the rights of the other individual who was not infringing. Got it? Okay, so you have a right to travel. I'll grant you that, okay? The road that you're traveling your ass down in your mobile metal coffin, which is what it can become when it's smacked into by a truck by a guy that doesn't know what the hell he's doing, okay? Kill you and your kids, right? They have the same right of travel. You both have your right to live. Collectively, as owners of the road, we have decided on protocol for people to be trusted with a vehicle that can do over 100 miles an hour. 100 miles an hour. Let's look at a car, just a typical sedan. Let's look at what it's capable of doing. So I looked up and found an energy calculator, and this is what I wanted to know. The average car weighs 4,000 pounds. And how fast does that car have to be going to provide 1,000,000 foot-pounds of energy on impact? The answer is 86 miles an hour. So when you let a person climb into a car that can do a couple hundred miles an hour, or 100 miles an hour, let's say, and they're cruising down the road at 86 miles an hour, and they impact you, with a typical car, they're going to apply about 1,000,000 foot-pounds of energy on impact. And I have a right as a co-owner of that road to have a voice in what the requirements are for you to be trusted with that vehicle on my road. Well, what about a gun, Jack? A gun can kill people, and you have a right to own a gun. Well, you have a right to own a car, too. No one says you don't have a right to own a car. If you can afford a car, I mean, if you're going to finance a car, the financing companies might say in order to give you the money, you have to have a driver's license, you have to have insurance, you have to have all that stuff, right? But if you just want to go down to the Toyota dealership and say, I'd like a new 4Runner, and they go, that's $37,527, and you go, let me get my checkbook out, and you write them a check, and you go, okay, let's make sure the check is good, it's your car. You know, anything you want to with it, but if you want to drive it on my road, then you have to go through my requirements to drive it on my road. Well, there is no my road. It's our road. And society, through the electoral process and through voting, has decided collectively that the requirements of a driver's license and insurance make sense. Now, that doesn't mean I have to agree with the requirements making sense. In fact, I actually would say this, based on the behavior I've seen on roads and the incompetence I've seen of drivers, I don't think that right now a person is qualified to drive just because they have a driver's license. I'd actually like to see more intelligence required before you're trusted on the road that I collectively own with everybody else. With a vehicle capable that easily of providing 1,000,000 foot-pounds of energy upon impact to myself and other people. All right, so I don't think we're actually stringent enough on the requirement for capacity to comprehend what the hell you're doing to drive. I think that basically, if, you know, now I'm going to sound like a statist, but honest to God, the way I see some people drive, that I would, instead of giving people fines, I'd have a little punch tool for police officers. And you punch a hole in your license and give it back to you. And if I get like to a point where you got four holes and I'm giving you a fifth hole, well, then we just call up a truck and they smash your car into a cube. You don't get to drive anymore at all, ever. I don't really believe that. But that's how I feel sometimes due to the incompetence I see on the road. Driving on a public road is a privilege. Yes, it is. Because it involves the assets of other people. And when something involves the assets of other people, you don't have a right to it. Just like you don't have a right to your money, you don't have a right to my road. Because you're part of the ownership, you have a right to a say-so in how that goes, but you don't have the right to just change it as one person or as a small minority of people. The ownership has been established in the way that it has. I think it's the stupidest argument out of the liberty community there is. I think it's immensely harmful to the liberty movement because it makes us look stupid. Libnoremus. That's what we are. Well, Jack, back in the day when they had horses, and if you would have told somebody that they have to have a license to ride their horse down the road, horses don't do 86 or 100 miles an hour. Okay, and there were certain things that you had to do and didn't have to do to be on a road back then, and the collective ownership made that decision then, and the collective ownership makes this decision now. And if you think, well, back in the 30s and 40s, you didn't even need a license, first of all, you're wrong. Second of all, if you look at when cars first went on the roads and some of the laws that were passed then, and some of the ridiculous laws that they tried to pass that didn't go through about things like a man carrying a lantern to go through an intersection in town in front of you and how dangerous it was to be doing 12 miles an hour, etc. Hey, you know what? It's not like policing the roads is new. And again, I want as minimal a state as possible. I'm in agreement with that. And if you put in a private road, I think you should be able to set any requirements at all you want for that road. But a proof of competency so a person can drive, yeah, I'm for that. Now, could we as a society decide, you know what, here's what we'll do. We'll set out some requirements to prove that you're competent and know how to run a vehicle. And then we'll let private organizations issue a certification, and as long as that private organization can show that their certification meets the competency that we collectively agree upon for the use of our road, then any one of those organizations can be issuing you a certification of competence. That would be a private solution for the competence, but that doesn't exist yet. And the collective owners of the road haven't decided in their wisdom to do that yet, so you have to comply with that. And if you think you have a right to drive without a license, please tell me who you are. so that if I see you, I can get the hell out of your way. And when you get pulled over, try explaining that to the law enforcement officer that will explain to you, yeah, it doesn't work that way. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack, this is Chris near Atlanta, and my question is for expert council member Darby Simpson. Darby, is paddock shifting important when you only have a couple of cows? Here's the details. My father-in-law has about 8 acres of mostly unfenced pasture, and we want to install fencing to keep about 3 or 4 cows. We're not sure if we should be concerned with rotational grazing or paddock shifting with such a small number of animals on that much land. I realize that without knowing what shape the pasture's in, you may not be able to get too specific. But my gut kind of says that they're going to eventually overgraze all their favorite grass and leave the stuff they don't want as much, which could degrade the pasture over time. I guess the larger question kind of boils down to whether or not to fence in the entire acreage and just let them roam free, which would certainly be less management day to day. Or should we break it down into some smaller paddocks, which could save us quite a bit of money on fencing and let us more actively manage their grazing? I hope that makes sense. Anyway, Darby, thanks for your guidance and for everything you do to support the show. Have a great one.
Hey, Jack, this is Darby Simpson calling in to answer the question from Chris near Atlanta about paddock shifting and the importance of using paddock shift with only having 3 or 4 cows on a small amount of acreage. Chris's main question was, is this important to do when you have a small number of cattle? And the answer is emphatically yes. It is extremely important. It doesn't matter if you have 2 or 3 cows or if you have 2 or 300 cows. Paddock shifting every day is extremely important. Chris had mentioned that his gut instinct is that the cows will tend to overgraze their favorite grasses if they just let them go out there and roam. And Chris, that is absolutely what will happen. In Joel Salatin's book, he talks about grasses being like this smorgasbord. It's like you and I showing up at Old Country Buffet and looking at all these foods on that buffet. And on that buffet is everything from steak and ice cream all the way down to liver and onions. And that's exactly how cattle view grasses. There are grasses that are really choice to them, and there are grasses that they would prefer not to eat. And what will happen is if you just let them go out there and continuously graze, they're just going to walk around and keep nibbling on all the ice cream, on all the really good grasses that they really prefer. And they'll kind of eat some of the grasses that are in the middle, and then the stuff down at the other end, the opposite end of the spectrum, they're just going to totally avoid those. And what's going to happen over time is as they continuously graze those choice grasses, you don't have the foliage to keep redeveloping the root system in those grasses or legumes, and they will actually just slowly die out. And in time, what you'll have is what a lot of fields or a lot of pastures around my place look like. It's just going to be 100% fescue. And the fescue in and of itself is not a great diet for cattle. I mean, they can live on it, but they're not going to get fat, and they're not going to taste as good either. So what I would suggest doing is that if you've got this 8 acres, and for the sake of conversation, since I don't know what it looks like or what shape it is, we'll just say that it's roughly a 600 foot by 600 foot square box. And what I would tell you to do is to, put in good perimeter, high tensile electric fence all the way around the outside of that. And for cattle, you could get away with, 4 wires. I'd tell you to probably go ahead and do 7 or 8 because high tensile wire is cheap. That's the inexpensive part of the fencing system. And then depending on what the shape of it looks like, you might want to put in 1 section of internal fencing to kind of break that into 2 bigger areas. And that could just be 2 or 3 wires, and your line posts for that could be on 40 foot or 50 foot intervals as opposed to 16 foot on the outside. And then what you want to do is you actually want to strip graze inside of these bigger areas. And so to do that, what we use here, we really like the O'Brien Tredaline step-in posts and the O'Brien 3-to-1 geared reels and then StayFix wire, 9 wire stainless steel conductor. I buy all that stuff from Ken Cove, kencove.com. And then you're just giving them a day's worth of food every day, and you're going to move them every day. And the reason we want to do that is we want to give these paddocks as much time to rest and recuperate and regrow as possible. And by moving the cows every day and just giving them enough food for that one day, by the time we make it back around to that first paddock, it's going to be regrown. And all the good grasses and all the medium grasses and all the crummy grasses that they're not too crazy about, it's all going to be back up at the same height. And they'll go in. Of course, they're gonna eat the choice stuff. They're going to knock down and walk on the crummy stuff, a lot of that being fescue, and they're going to build soil for you. And this is really important, too. I mean, that is a form of permaculture. That is chop and drop, and you're using four-legged lawnmowers to go out there and knock those grasses down and build soil. So that's kind of what I would tell you to do. And then if just all you need is a portable waterer with a $13 float valve and some garden hose and like a 30-gallon tub, and just hook that up to a hydrant near a house or barn and just move it around with them each and every day. And what you're going to see is some really amazing results within a year or two of how much better those grasses are going to look. You know, I went to a conference one time that Greg Judy spoke at, and I remember him talking about a guy that lived not too far away from him in Missouri. And this guy had come to one of his on-farm seminars and was learning about, you know, rotational grazing and mobbing the cattle and all this stuff. And this guy had enough money to buy two cows. And he was literally, Greg Judy talked about this story. This guy was literally rotationally grazing two cows out in his front yard, just letting the grass grow tall and just moving them around every day. And it's just as important with two cows or 200 cows. It really doesn't matter. I don't know what shape all your fence is in, but it would be worthwhile to get that perimeter fence in really good condition. Given that you've got 8 acres and I don't know what it looks like, even if it's like just terrible and awful, you could still put, you know, 4 or 5 good sized cattle out there. They don't need to be monsters. There's an article on my website you can read about selecting cattle for grass based systems. I actually want smaller cattle. Go find you some year or year and a half old calves and buy 4 or 5 of them and stick them out there. And a couple of things to do to improve the grasses. One, you're going to be rotationally grazing them, right? And then the other thing we can do is when we get into this coming spring, you can do something that's called frost seeding. And what you do is when your ground is getting near its, you know, kind of last frost date, and it's getting into that freezing and thawing where it's, you know, just kind of just below freezing and gets above freezing each day and night, what you can do is go out and sow some different clovers. And if you want to, alfalfa, a little caveat on alfalfa, that's now a genetically modified crop. So if you're going to buy alfalfa seed, I would tell you to actually spring for the certified organic stuff or just avoid it altogether. But you can actually go out and just frost seed clover, and that freezing and thawing action in the soil is going to pull those seeds down in, and you're going to re-sow that clover. And that's something that you're probably going to have to do every few years because clover and alfalfa both do tend to die out over time. But, man, get, you know, some white clover, some red clover, all-site clover, whatever, but put 2 or 3 different varieties out there. And if you've got some really bad spots, you could look at doing some annuals like cowpeas, millet, buckwheat, things of that nature to get the soil organic matter back in shape to where it will support some more grasses. There's nothing wrong with having fescue out there, but again, fescue by itself is just not something that you want to graze cattle on the whole time. And then what I would tell you to do is, you know, going into next year, if you've had 4 or 5 calves on it, go ahead and go buy 4 or 5 more, because with 8 acres, you should be able to support in time, you know, 8 to 10 animals pretty easily if you've got good management techniques. So, no fears there. I mean, then you'll have, you know, 4 or 5 bigger ones and 4 or 5 smaller ones. And I'll be honest with you, with 8 acres, I don't know what you do for a living, but you got a nice little side business that's just begging to kind of blossom here, where you could, you know, keep 1 or 2 cows for your family and your dad's family or what have you, and then sell 2 or 3 cows off. And that's a very profitable thing to do. Once you have your infrastructure in, the only cost you have are replacing the cows. And it's a great little side business to make some money. So yeah, those were kind of my basic thoughts, and really appreciate the question. You did a really nice job in how you answered or asked that, and then provided all the details. And hey, you're absolutely welcome. I love answering these questions. I love helping people out. Love inspiring people to get started in farming and claiming a little piece of liberty and raising some meat for themselves. So hey, I hope you find this helpful, and good luck with it. And chime in and, you know, let us know how it goes. But I'd say go for it. 8 acres in a couple of years, man, that grass could be looking really good. Oh yeah, something else you might consider doing is doing a soil test now and sending it into Logan Labs in Ohio, and then like each year do an additional soil test and just watch how it improves, watch the minerals go up, watch the soil organic matter go up, things of that nature. To learn more about me, you can visit my website at darbysimpson.com. Thanks so much, Jack. Take care.
Before I take the next question, just adding to Darby's excellent answer, I mentioned Mark Shepard's book earlier, and what it made me think of when I heard this question was a chapter in Mark's book where he talks about rotational grazing and how important it is. And here's what he said. He said, just down the road for me is an eco-hippie, you know, typical eco-hippie that's going to save the world with his eco-hippie nonsense. And he has four cows on 13 acres, and he has read that you can put 13 cows on 13 acres, and you can really easily handle one cow per acre, which may or may not be true, depending. You may be able to handle more or less, depending on the pasture or whatever. But one cow an acre is a pretty good number to look at. And because of that, he decided he would go lighter, and he put three cows, or four cows, I can't remember what the number is, on it. And he knows damn well now that those people are liars and that it will destroy the land, because his three or four cows have destroyed his 13 acres. So next year he'll keep less cows, and he will further destroy his land and become even more convinced that you need like 50 acres for one cow eventually, and eventually there'll be no cows in a destroyed piece of land. Whereas my land is handling more than that, and we're just down the road from him, and my land is rich and lush and wonderful. And he is convinced that it can't be true, and he won't listen to anybody that talks about it. He thinks everybody's lying, because he's proven it to himself by having these three or four cows on 13 acres, and they have ruined it. And they've ruined it for the exact reasons that the caller's instincts told them were true, and exactly for what Darby has said to you. I don't care how few cows you have, they have to be shifted, or eventually they'll destroy everything, because they are not meant in a natural system to be a quote-unquote free range. That's not what they're supposed to be. Natural systems and heavy grazing herbivores like cattle and any species of wild animal you can think of that would be an analog to a cow, like a buffalo or a wildebeest or a gazelle or anything like that, have evolved with nature to exist in a paddock shift model through the use of apex predators. In Africa, it would be lions. In America, it would have been the wolf and cougars and things like that. So they act in a pack mob grazing mentality, and they shift themselves. We've altered that by removing the apex predators and through the use of fencing and roads and cutting off migratory routes. And then cows have been domesticated to the point where they don't even behave that way. And if you put an apex predator, they're kind of not going to even still function that way. So unless we're going to get rid of all the barbed wire, all the fences, all the roads, all the railroad tracks, and bring back the apex predators, we have to push those animals through that system ourselves the way that nature would if we weren't here. And paddock shift is how you do that. So I just wanted to add that, and let's take another question.
Hey, Jack, this is Connie from St. Louis. I own Premier Tattoo, the local tattoo shop. We decided to start offering specific discounts to certain professionals on a weekly basis. It kind of differs by our clientele and reward our Facebook fans. We decided the first week we were going to do first responders. Then we started getting a bunch of requests. Most common, absolutely by far, was, what about SAHMs? I had no idea what that was. I looked it up. Some sort of something adolescent health medicine. Fine. We had a business powwow. We decided if your daily routine involves a bulletproof vest, an oxygen tank, scrubs, or a scalpel, you get 20% off in distillery. Enjoy. And then the crap hit the fan. And it turns out the complaint was, we are our children's first responders. We are our children's nurses. We are our children's heroes. And SAHM stands for stay-at-home moms. And I was absolutely, completely in awe at the thought that these women had such a sense of entitlement that they not only believed, but argued that they deserved the same discount as police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and emergency personnel because they made a choice to stay at home and feel their kids hot dogs all day. So just interested in what you thought. Anyway, thanks for what you do.
The biggest reason I played this is it does speak to a entitlement mentality that exists throughout our country and with what I call equivalency dementia. Okay, what's equivalency dementia? That's when you think what you do is equivalent to another person, and the only explanation I can give for your logic is you have freaking situational dementia, not situational lack of situational awareness. You have situational dementia. You have assigned yourself certain heroic attributes that do not apply to yourself, and you think they do, and you'll do anything you can to try to justify that. Where I see it most frequently, because I do a first responder discount for people that I feel have put themselves in harm's way for the betterment of humanity. And I extend that to military and law enforcement, and I take flack for that sometimes because people go, you are so hard on the state, and you think the government should be smaller, and the police officers are the ones that enforce the state's will, and the soldiers are the ones that enforce the nation's will. And if you're listening to me and you're one of those guys, you're one of the good guys, and we need you. That's how I justify that. If you can listen, if you're a cop and you can listen to me rail on bad cops the way I do, I want you in the field, man. I really do. I want you grabbing that good cop by the neck and busting his ass when he steps out. I really do. So, you know, that's my, but the reality is the soldier and the law enforcement officer risk their life. I do it for Peace Corps because when I was a soldier, basically doing humanitarian aid, and that was the main thing my unit did when it was deployed. We built roads and schools. We didn't blow people up. I served alongside members of the Peace Corps, and we were safer and more comfortable than they were. So I know that they are in third world nations risking their life, risking their health for the betterment of humanity. I know that. I do it for first responders like EMTs, firefighters, paramedics, that type of thing. And I do that because I know that they're out there in the field and they're often sent into places where it's dangerous to save lives. And I do that to recognize them. And do you know who I hear from that want the service discount too? Because what they do is just as heroic and just as dangerous. Some of you already know where I'm going to go, and I'm not putting the profession down as a whole, but there are people that have equivalency dementia. Teachers. Yep. Teachers. I had one teacher write me, and she said, or it was a he, and he said, do you know what? You say that we're not at risk, but just a week ago, a school a couple counties over was on lockdown because they thought there was a shooter. That's equivalency dementia. This person is saying, because a few counties away, a school thought there was a shooter that wasn't, locked down the school. That didn't affect him at all. His job is equivalently dangerous to a police officer who, frankly, is just as likely to be killed at a traffic stop trying to help somebody by a motorist who runs him over as to be shot by a perpetrator. In fact, I'll bet you, I don't have the statistics, I bet you more police officers die or are seriously injured because they're hit by vehicles while they're either citing or rendering aid than are through being shot or stabbed or anything else. I'll bet the number one cause of disability among police officers is automotive related. So they're risking that. And so is the paramedic that's putting you on a board. And these teachers, as few of them as there are, have this equivalency dementia. Really? You're a stay-at-home mom, so you are equivalent? You are equivalent in risking your life as a first responder to a paramedic who last night had blood on his face while he carried somebody off of a highway? Or a police officer that responded to a domestic because some woman said she was being beaten, and while they were trying to help her, she stabbed him? you're equivalent to that because you're a stay-at-home mom? You've got to be freaking kidding me. That doesn't mean I don't respect what it takes to be a mother. But you know what? It takes a lot to be a father, too. And maybe that's why so many sorry-ass men run away from that responsibility. Because it takes a lot to be a father, too. But you don't deserve special recognition because you're a mommy or a daddy. If you've chosen to engage in the activity that procreates life, you don't get a reward for being a mommy or a daddy from society. Your reward is getting to be a good mom or a good dad. Your reward is watching that child grow into a good man or a good woman. Your reward is the child itself. You're not rewarded for having a child by others. You have a having a child creates a responsibility. And it amazes me. I've heard the argument from young single mothers. Well, it makes you grow up. No, the fact that you didn't grow up is, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, why you are a young single mother on your own. And just like you don't, if you go to college and get a degree, you're not qualified for a job. You have an education that qualifies you to learn a job. Having a child doesn't make you a mother. Having a child doesn't make you a mother. Having a child doesn't make you a father. Those words are earned. They're earned. And they're not earned through the lens of society. They're earned through the child who grows and at the point that they're old enough to comprehend things, chooses to use those words when they talk about you, my mother and my father. That's your reward. And if that's not enough, well, frankly, you're not worth giving an explanation to. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. Karim from Chicagoland calling with an expert panel question for Frank Sharp. I've gone through 3 different carry guns and an entire drawer full of holsters at this point for concealed carry since I got my permit about 5 months ago. My question is, as far as having something for very discreet carry, if I'm carrying in locations where I'm going to be dressing in a way that it will be obvious if I'm carrying my everyday carry gun. What are your thoughts on like the North American Arms micro revolvers and the Derringers from Bond Arms? Thanks. Bye.
Hi, Jack. This is Frank at Fortress Defense responding to the listener question regarding small pistols for summer carry. The specific question was about the North American Arms mini revolvers and the Bond Arms Derringers. The North American Arms guns, as far as I know, only come in .22 caliber, and probably the best way to state this would be if you shoot someone with a .22 and they find out about it, they're going to be really angry. The .22 is not something I have as a defensive caliber recommendation. Of course, any gun is better than no gun. If that's all you can get on you, more power to you, not on my recommended list. The Bond Arms Derringers, Bond Arms has a decent reputation as a company. That wouldn't be the issue. The real issue is your limited ammunition with those guns. It's a 2-shot gun. If you think your fight will be over in 2 shots and that's all it's going to take, more power to you. I do not plan my life that way. This day and age, we are making 9mm very small. Glock has their new G42 out that's in .380. That's at the low end of my recommended calibers, but still a decent gun. There's the Carr Arms guns, the Smith & Wesson Shield. There's a bunch of things to choose from that I would recommend you try and try to get those working in your life somehow before you resort to these small revolvers and Derringers. For the rest of the listeners, Fortress will be in Houston, Texas on September 6th and 7th. We're offering a level 1 handgun course out there. It's 20 hours with a night shoot. You can get a hold of us at 708-522-8060. And our email is info@fortressdefense.com. Once again, this is Frank from Fortress Defense, and may you all have victory.
Yeah, I would completely agree with Frank that the guns that you asked about, Krim, just are not guns that I would personally choose to carry as a defensive weapon unless I had no other alternative. In addition to some of the great things that Frank mentioned, Kel-Tec makes some really great, compact, lightweight carry guns. frankly, I can't see a situation where any type of clothing without proper gear, if you wanted to be, you know, purchasing something relatively cheap, but quite proven as a reasonable gun carried by a lot of law enforcement officers as a backup gun, is the Bursa 380. That's a pretty small frame weapon. You can carry that wearing, you know, board shorts and a t-shirt, quite well concealed. Some of the stuff from Kel-Tec conceals even better. The guns Frank mentioned, all I can't really see a situation unless you're walking around in a Speedo. And I think that Derringer is going to be a problem anyway, unless you look a little bit too enhanced. That's all I could say there. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. This is Keith from Colorado. Hey. So this is in response to the listener feedback show. And I don't know if these guys, you know, ship or deliver or what, but, you know, where the in Olathe, Colorado, where, the, you know, Olathe's famous sweet corn goes across the country and whatnot, they have non-GMO corn that they use. There's a place down here called Western Slope Ag Center, and they are doing a non-GMO broiler chicken feed that's 22% protein, and he quoted me just now, for 100 pounds, it's $22. That halves what we've been paying for non-GMO feed, and we just by chance kind of find out that they just started making this mix. They started doing it for layer hens. Now they've got a game bird started that they can substitute the non-GMO corn for. And like I said, it had, you know, the non-GMO corn they have to do is because the sweet corn, because it's all being eaten by people. So they've actually got a bunch of fields out here that are non-GMO. And if you want to substitute the straight corn for any other feed, game bird feed, stuff like that, it's only $5 more per 100 pounds. Like I said, I don't know if they deliver, but they do the one-ton grain totes. So if anybody else is interested, or maybe there's another place close by to some of these guys, just call the local elevator and see if they can do the straight corn. Because at least here, the movement for non-GMO has gotten to the point where they've had to do this. I contacted these guys a year ago, and they couldn't do it. And all of a sudden now, they're not only doing it, but it's cheap comparatively to the other elevators out east where we used to shop, where I used to ranch, that wanted to charge us for the same, almost the same exact protein content and analysis of nutrients. They wanted to charge us $43 for a 40-pound bag. So, you know, like I said, it's great news on the GMO front. Also, like I said, I don't know if they deliver, but if you're doing enough broilers, because we're upgrading our operation to about 500 broilers every 6 to 8 weeks. So it is good news for guys out there trying to do the Joe Salton-style chicken tractors with non-GMO feed. Anyways, Jack, love what you do. Hopefully this helps some of those guys out there. Talk to you soon. Bye.
You know, that is good. And I think the other thing is if growers, of especially poultry, will start asking for non-GMO feed, all of a sudden they'll start realizing that there's a market for it, and more people will put together feed mixes that are non-GMO, and there's an option there. The only little hackle raiser in that whole soliloquy from that caller was it has to be non-GMO because it's for human consumption. There's nothing that makes corn for human consumption have to be non-GMO. You're eating GMO corn every time you eat a corn product in this country, damn near. And most of the corn that you buy is GMO corn. Whether it's in a can or on a cob, doesn't matter, or in a freezer bag. It's probably GMO. Now, this brand is non-GMO, so that corn is just, don't think because it's corn for people that it's not GMO. It doesn't work that way. Or don't just think because it's a sweet corn it's not GMO, because it doesn't work that way either, sadly enough. But I think really the message there is the more demand we create as people that have livestock, from small home growers to commercial growers, the more of it there will be. If people see a demand that's real, then they meet it. Now, the pricing's excellent. I need to look around and see if anything like that's available around here. I buy Texas Natural Feeds, and it's non-GMO, non-soy, and those two are both important to me. I don't want, especially my layers, eating soy. I really don't want soy in my eggs. I have my reasons for that. I won't make the show long by, you know, longer than it already is by going into that, but I want non-soy, non-GMO in my birds. And that feed costs me about the same this guy's paying for 100 pounds for a 50-pound sack. So I'm paying double what this guy's paying for. So if I can find an alternative, I'm all for it. And a 1,000-pound tote, there's no reason for me not to buy 1,000 pounds of feed, honestly. It stores very, very well. They'll tell you, oh, it only lasts 3 months. Whatever, get out of here. Go away. Don't bother me. Because I'll go through it in a year easy. So why not? I mean, if I look at it that way, it's 20 bags of feed. I'm usually picking up 4 to 6 bags of feed every time I go to the feed store. So I'm probably using about 1,000 pounds of feed a year, or will be with the increase in size of the flock and the past movement of meat birds through. So, yeah, good stuff. And I think it's just showing more and more people want it. So more and more of it's showing up. So the big thing I would tell you is if you say, well, I want to buy non-GMO, but I can't find it, ask every time you go, do you have anything non-GMO? And if you choose to buy GMO feed, say, you know what, I'm buying this, I'm constantly looking for somebody else. The minute that I find a source, if it's not here, you're losing my business. Don't be nasty about it, but make it clear. This is important to me, and it's important to my family, my community, my customers, what have you. And when I find the better option, I'm going to take it. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. Kevin from Texas. Hey, just listened to the 6-year anniversary show. Man, hard to believe it's been that long. Hey, kudos to you on kind of going back to the way it used to be. Not going back to the car, obviously, where I'm at right now. But the fact that you're looking at maybe doing, because I love the feedback show on Mondays and comments on the Friday show and all that good stuff, but yeah, I sure did always love it when Jack would give us a little insight on all his stuff throughout the week. And not that I don't mind the interviews, they're nice every once in a while, but man, I tell you what, I sure would like to get back to the way it used to be when we heard from Jack 3 to 5 times a week. Thanks again, buddy. Hey, congratulations on everything. It's been a great time, been a great ride. And definitely learned and lived a lot. Thanks.
Well, thanks for that. And I think it's something that we actually need to do at this point. I think that if we do one interview a week on average, and there's 50 weeks in a year that we're on the air, we're probably off air for 2 weeks a year, that probably means that there's 50 interviews a year. And I think that's plenty. And I think that the show was built on mostly me teaching subjects, going into what we're doing, going into what we're planning, giving my take on things. And, you know, some of the things we're doing, like setting up, I need to get kind of set up to be able to do what I said I'd do with the council, with providing them a question every week to make it something so in my routine. And that's, people ask all the time, how do you do so much? I have routines. And it's not magical, and it's not special, and I don't use special software, and I just get in a routine. And once I'm in that routine, well, it's just going to happen. So I need to set things up so I can get in the routine about a certain point on a certain day that I give everybody a question and send them off for the council. So that hasn't happened yet. But the plan to go to the single interview a week format, that's been implemented by Dorothy. She does all the scheduling. And I think it's about mid-July we'll cross over from 2 interview weeks to single interview weeks, and we're staying there. And I will say this, I'm going to be much tougher screening interviews in the future. I think that if I'm just tougher on potential interviewees and make sometimes say, you know what, you're going to provide me more information about what we're going to do, and you're going to give me more examples of what we're going to cover to be sure that it's worth taking an hour of the audience's time for, and be a little tougher on my screening of interviewees. And some people may not like that if they're on that end of it, but I'm sorry. That alone will probably cut out, you know, 10 to 20% of what we do. So we're going to be tougher to get on the air with. I'm going to be, if you're a potential guest, what are you doing for the audience? I don't mean financially. What are you doing for the audience's education? If you want to tell us about your business or whatever, write me a letter. Maybe I'll read it. I mean, that's it. You know, maybe I'll write up a little bit of blurb up and send it in. If it makes sense, fits in, I'll put it on the air for you. But we don't need an hour of anybody telling us how great their business is or their company is or their ideas. We need guests that tell our audience, this is what you can do in your life. I fundamentally believe that the success that TSP has enjoyed has been because the majority of the content that I deliver is focused on what you can do versus what's wrong with what other people do. I really do. And as I look back at 6 years and I think about the best things to come out of TSP, They've always been about what you can do. And the best guests and the best interviews have been the guests that come on and go, this is what we're doing and this is how it applies to you. This is what we're doing and how it applies to you. This is how you can do it. This is where you can get more information about it. And even the people that are in business for themselves, like, yeah, we do that. We'll help you, but you don't need us. We're there for the people that want to go to the extra level or what have you. That servant attitude is what makes the great guests in TSP, and it's what I'll look for more of for you. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, and we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Revolution.